For alliteration. Blandock's face took on a look of amazement and childlike glee. He clapped his hands together.
Yes, indeed. If you were to go to the castle and retrieve Oban, we would gladly give you all the Diluine you could ever need.
Philip said,
Well, that seems settled then, if you all would just tell us the way to this castle.
Cragganmore, Jimmy said.
Quite,
Philip said.
Please, tell us the way to go there.
The miners erupted into spontaneous cheering, followed by singing and a surprisingly well-choreographed dance number. Giant flagons of beer appeared, as if from nowhere, seemingly for the purpose of spilling on the ground as they danced. Delicious-looking roasted drumsticks from some animal that was far too large to be a chicken, or even a turkey, also appeared, but were waved in the air rather than eaten. Tyler said,
I figure they'll tell us the way when they're done celebrating.
Yep, probably, Jimmy agreed. The miners enjoyed their pre-programmed celebration all through the night. The next morning, the wizards were given fresh water and directions to Castle Cragganmore. Of course, the directions had consisted of pointing to one of the three paths that led away from the mine and saying, That one. But still, it saved the wizards some guesswork. The mountains had given way to rolling hills, so the terrain itself no longer seemed to be trying to kill them. The downside of this was that instead of only having to watch in front of them and behind them for attacks from mountain wolves, now they had to watch in all directions for attacks from what the miners referred to as hill wolves. Hill wolves differed from mountain wolves in that they lived in the hills instead of the mountains. That was where the differences ended. They looked identical, attacked via the same pattern, and appeared with the same regularity. The only real difference from the wizard's point of view was that you couldn't just chuck them off a cliff, because there was no cliff. Hurling them down a hill only worked if you were standing at the top of the hill, and even then it only gave you a moment to regroup while the wolf ran back up the hill. Instead, they took to counting to three, then simply stabbing the wolves out of the air. The path was wide and well-trodden and began to parallel a large, fast-moving river. The river started to descend into a picturesque canyon, which seemed to have been carved by the river. Philip thought,
For the first time since this ridiculous quest began, we're almost having a nice time. Sure, we're trapped in a poorly designed death maze, at the mercy of a man who doesn't know what the word means, because he's both cruel and stupid. But the weather is nice, and thanks to the river and its gorge, the hill wolves can only attack us from two directions again.
Philip was torn from his reverie by Tyler, who was pointing at the water and yelling,
River wolf!
A wolf swam clumsily through the treacherous currents, dragged itself up onto land, growled for the traditional amount of time, then leapt for Tyler's throat, got stabbed, and hit the ground with a wet thud. The river canyon twisted and turned through the landscape, and the path followed. The walls around the wizards grew steeper, and the blue sky above them narrowed to a blue slit visible beyond the canyon rim. It was still broad daylight outside the canyon, but in the shadows down along the riverbank, it felt like dusk. They became aware that the canyon seemed to widen ahead of them. Soon they saw that the course of the river had gently turned one direction, then bent back upon itself in a turn so sharp it almost created a full loop. The forces of gravity and erosion had worked together, most likely at Todd's direction, to form a giant bowl with steep rock walls easily 100 feet tall. The river shot around the bottom of the bowl so quickly that it actually raked outward at an angle, like the surface of a whirlpool, before completing its right-hand turn, and then taking a violent left away from the bowl and down the remainder of the canyon. The riverbed was littered with immense boulders that had no doubt fallen from the high walls around the bend. They poked up through the surface of the water, creating violent currents and making navigation of the river by boat impossible. In the middle of these turbulent hairpin turns, the canyon's far wall narrowed into a teardrop-shaped spit of land that formed the inner bank of the bend. On this dry, stony outcropping, there was a castle, so gothic it might as well have been wearing black eyeliner. Buttresses supported larger buttresses, which supported arches, which supported stained glass windows, balconies, gargoyles, and spires so numerous and packed together so tightly that there appeared to be no visible building at their source. From a distance, it looked like a black stone pincushion. The castle's island narrowed to a knife's edge of stone. The path the wizards had been following led across this land bridge, but it offered little reassurance. The path was lined on both sides with rushing white water, heading in opposite directions. To fall from either side would mean certain death. Between this natural bridge and the castle stood a small army of large men. Thus, making it safely across the bridge also meant certain death. Tyler said,
"That must be Castle Craggamore."
"Are you sure?"
Gary asked.
"We're on the path to Castle Craggamore,"
Tyler explained.
"And the path ends at that castle. So unless there's another, smaller castle hiding inside that castle, yeah, I'm pretty sure."
The men backtracked, ducking around the corner to make themselves harder for any prying eyes from the castle to spot. They climbed as far up the canyon wall as they dared to get a better view. They surveyed the situation and started to plan.
"I say we give up,"
Philip said.
"This is madness. Clearly Todd has set this up just so he can watch us all die horribly at the hands of those soldiers. Or maybe, if he's very lucky, we'll fall into the river and be dashed on the rocks before we get within killing range. Either way, I say we refuse to move and make Todd come down here and show us the courtesy of killing us himself."
Gary said,
"I don't think it's as hopeless as all that."
Philip said,
"Think again."
"No, seriously,"
Gary said.
"Look over there, guys."
He pointed across the river to the far canyon wall. Because the river had effectively cut a groove in the earth, the various strata formed by different layers of minerals were visible in cross-section. Tyler squinted and said,
"What am I looking for? I see striations in the rock, but that's about all."
"Striations. Do you mean stripes?"
Gary asked.
"Yeah,"
Tyler said.
"I guess I do."
"Then why don't you just say that?"
Gary asked.
"Because those kinds of stripes are called striations."
"Whatever,"
Gary said.
"There are a couple of them that are bigger and flatter than the others. They make a kind of ledge. Just wide enough that if we went sideways, one at a time, I think we could walk on them."
Jimmy said,
"Yeah, I suppose, if we could find a way across the river. But what good would that do us? The castle is on this side of the river, not over there." "Those soldiers aren't on that side of the river either,"
Gary said.
"And if you look down there, where the river goes around the castle, you see all those boulders?"
Jimmy and Tyler said that they did.
"Some of them are pretty close together, aren't they? Almost close enough that someone could jump from rock to rock and make their way across the river."
Philip said,
"The whole way along the cliff we'd be sitting ducks. If they have any archers, they'll use us for target practice."
"So we wait for nightfall,"
Gary said.
"It'll be clear tonight. There'll be plenty of moonlight for us to see by, but the soldiers won't be looking for us. They're guarding the path."
Philip considered this for a moment, then said,
"Okay. Say we do scrabble along the cliff face in the dark of the night, then successfully leap across the rapids. What then? How do we get the canary?"
Gary smiled.
"We steal it. We go in like burglars, find where they're keeping the canary, take it, and get out the same way we got in."
Philip looked over to Tyler and Jimmy. Jimmy was peering into the distance at the rocks, planning. Tyler was deep in thought, but there was a hint of a smile on his face. Philip shook his head.
That's pretty optimistic, Gary. What makes you think we can pull this off?
Gary smiled broadly.
I know something none of you know. Something that will help.
Tyler and Jimmy both turned and looked at Gary. Philip was also waiting to hear what he would say next. Gary savored the moment, then said,
I know the stealth secret of the ninjas.
Tyler turned to Philip and said,
He really had me up until he said that last bit.
Gary said,
No, really, guys, we can do this. Tyler, you know I'm telling the truth. I've used the secret to sneak up on you. Remember that one time I stuck your hand in that bowl of warm water?
Tyler said,
I was asleep.
Yeah,
Gary said.
And I didn't wake you up. That's gotta count for something.
Philip turned to Tyler and asked,
Does that really work, the bowl of warm water thing?
Yeah, Tyler said. If your goal is to make someone wake up with a wet hand, it works every time.
Gary said,
Look, I'll show you the secret, okay? I saw it on the Discovery Channel.
The other three agreed and stood respectfully while Gary explained his ancient stealth technique.
Okay, Gary said. Here's how the ninjas did it. They lowered their center of gravity. You don't quite crouch, but you bend your knees more than you normally would.
Gary lowered his stance, slightly hunching his shoulders.
Then you extend your elbows and your wrists. This gives you greater balance and allows you to feel obstacles that you can't see.
He spread his arms out wide and extended his hands in front of himself. Gary said,
You start with your weight distributed evenly across the soles of both your feet. Now, slowly shift your weight so that one foot is carrying the load. Then slowly extend the other foot forward. As you do, try to keep your pelvis moving in a straight line without raising or dipping. Slowly shift your weight to the forward foot, then repeat the process until you reach your goal. Move silently, silently, silently.
Gary demonstrated, walking stealthily in a circle several times, muttering,
Silently.
Tyler asked,
Do we have to keep repeating silently the whole time?
No,
Gary said.
That's just part of the demonstration.
Philip said,
Now we all know, gentlemen, the stealth secret of the ninjas was that they would sneak.
Gary ignored Philip, focusing on Tyler and Jimmy.
Come on, guys. What do you say?
Philip said,
No, Gary. It's an interesting idea, but I'm afraid it's hopeless.
So what then?
Gary asked.
You're gonna give up?
No,
Philip answered.
A few minutes ago I was going to give up. Now I have given up.
Gary was aghast.
I can't believe this. You're really just gonna wait here for Todd to show up and kill you?
Philip pointed to the castle in the distance.
It's better than going over there and killing myself for him.
Really? Really?
Gary whined.
Man, I just don't get you. You can't just give up like this. Surely it's gotta be better to die trying.
Trying to do what?
Philip asked.
Something dangerous and pointless for the amusement of someone who wants us to die anyway?
It's not pointless, Gary said. Your way, either the river wolves will get us, or Todd will pop up and take us out himself. Either way, we die. My way? We will probably be killed, but there's a small chance that we might live. And I don't think that's pointless.
Philip thought about this for a moment, then turned to Tyler and Jimmy and asked,
Do you two think this is a good idea?
Tyler said, No, it's a terrible idea. But We're going to do it.
Jimmy nodded agreement. Philip had expected that answer. For the most part, he even agreed with it. He was now objecting more out of momentum than because of any actual hope of winning the argument.
So we go with Gary's plan, even though we'll almost certainly be killed?
Philip asked. Jimmy shrugged.
We'll most likely die either way. At least Gary's way won't be boring.
10. They didn't have to backtrack far to find a part of the river that was narrow and boulder-strewn enough to work their way across. They spent the remaining time until nightfall eating wolf jerky, making sure anything they had that was reflective was covered, killing the occasional river wolf, and napping in the shade of the canyon walls. When it was dark enough to launch their assault, they crossed the river. As they leapt from rock to rock, Philip and Tyler found themselves on a boulder, surrounded by rapids, with Jimmy and Gary already across. It was the first chance they had to talk even semi-privately since the quest began, and they dawdled there, pretending to take a breather to capitalize on the opportunity. Philip said,
The boulders are just close enough together to make crossing the river possible, but dangerous. There coincidentally happens to be a side route to the castle that's just well hidden enough to be obvious. Doesn't this seem a little too easy?
Yeah, Tyler said. I've been thinking about that. Two things. One, Todd is a game designer. Now, I know you mainly play stuff like Gorf and Choplifter, but games get a lot more sophisticated later on. It's not unheard of for there to be more than one way to complete a mission. Could be that he deliberately made it so we could fight our way through the front door, or sneak around back.
Philip said,
Yeah, that would explain it.
Tyler said, Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that Todd went to a lot of trouble to make this quest. He wants to get maximum entertainment out of it. That means he wants us to survive, well, at least some of us, to the end. Also, he probably gave us the choice because he wants us to argue. He wants us at each other's throats.
Philip laughed.
I wondered why you were being so nice to Jimmy.
Yeah, Tyler said. Until we get out of this, or he gets killed, I'm going out of my way to be civil. But make no mistake, I can't stand the sight of him. I certainly don't trust him. You?
You know I've disliked the bastard longer than anyone. But in a weird way, I do trust him. I trust him to do what he thinks is best for him. Right now, he stands a better chance of surviving if we all stay alive to help him. So, yeah, I trust him to help the group for now. If at the end of this he's given a chance to sell us all out to save his own neck, I trust him to do that, too.
Philip and Tyler finally joined Jimmy and Gary on the far side of the river, and they were on their way. As predicted, there was a stratum of rock that extended from the one above it, just far enough to make a path that was wide and flat enough to walk on, yet narrow and uneven enough to cause constant fear of falling into the river. As they progressed, the canyon got deeper and the river farther below them. By the time they reached the sweeping blind corner that marked the beginning of the natural bowl that protected Castle Cragganmore, the narrow path was easily 50 feet above the river's surface, and the steep rocky slope below left no doubt in the wizards' minds that if they did fall, they'd be far too injured to swim properly by the time they made it to the water. The rapids did not look swimmable anyway, so it didn't matter. Falling from the path meant death. Whether you died from the fall or from drowning was an unimportant detail. Luckily, the soldiers all held torches, and they all had been lit at dusk. From a distance, the small army guarding the castle resembled the candles on an octogenarian's birthday cake. Clearly, they would not be able to see the wizards, as their night vision would be ruined by the torches. Nor would they even be looking for invaders halfway up the cliff wall. Even if they did, they would not fear four men foolish enough to get themselves into such a predicament in the first place.
I gotta hand it to Gary,
Philip thought.
This plan is so idiotic, It kind of goes all the way around the horn to being smart.
Slowly, they inched their way along the canyon wall. The path was still the same width, but the increased height and the darkness made it more precarious. The knowledge that falling would lead to death, either by being dashed on the rocks, drowning, or most likely being dashed on the rocks and drowning, did not make the path feel wider. After what seemed like an eternity, they were behind the castle. The physical structure of the castle was noticeable for its invisibility. The dull black stone swallowed the moonlight and starlight, reflecting almost nothing back. The light shed by the soldiers' torches was visible around and through the innumerable arches, buttresses, and complications of the castle's lower structure. Higher up, light poured out from the castle's stained glass windows. Philip had never seen glass that better deserved to be referred to as stained. The color palette ranged from dark red to light brown, with the occasional spot of sickly yellow as an accent. When the wizards reached the very back of the castle, the cliff face roughened, creating a rock formation down to the riverbank that fell somewhere between being stairs and a ladder. The river itself was strewn with boulders, spaced just far enough apart that it looked as if a person could just about kill themselves trying to jump across. Gary said, "Wow! What luck!" Jimmy looked back at Philip and Tyler and gave a brief smile. A smile that said,
"I know it isn't luck, and I know you both know it too."
They carefully picked their way down the cliff. The river was a raging torrent of white water and deafening noise. Crossing the maelstrom was made all the more nerve-wracking by the fact that every single boulder they touched on their way was slick with moisture and wobbled sickeningly, as if it could let go of the riverbed and be swept away at any moment. Once they were on solid ground again, the men lay there, trying to catch their breaths and slow their heart rates. They were badly winded and soaked to the bone, both from the spray of the river and their own sweat. When they were ready, the wizards set about finding a way into the castle. The only visible windows were the large stained-glass monstrosities toward the top of the castle, but they found the castle's exterior surprisingly easy to scale. They climbed the smallest buttresses with little difficulty, and they were able to scale the larger buttress with ease. The final buttress was a piece of cake, and then it was a short trip over the back of a gargoyle, and they were standing on a ledge outside a stained glass window. They had discussed the possibility of having to break the window to enter, but they found that toward the bottom of the window there was a hinged panel that allowed them to crawl into the castle. Once inside, they found themselves on a ledge, approximately 10 feet above an onyx-floored terrace that overlooked the interior of the castle. They dropped to the floor as quietly as they could. From where they crouched, they could see the floor in front of them, a curved railing and a wall in the distance. From the way the railing sloped downward and the floor stopped, they could tell there were staircases leading downward to the right and the left. Gary said,
"I'll go take a look around."
He started to rise, but Philip stopped him, grabbing his arm.
"Remember," Philip said, "you don't have to whisper silently while you're sneaking, hmm?"
Gary said,
"I know that. Jeez."
He turned his back to the others, bit his lip, and skulked to the railing. He cautiously peeked through the balusters. He rose a bit to look over the top of the rail. He extended his head well out over the handrail and craned his neck one way, then the other. He stood up straight, turned to face the others, and shrugged. After a moment's thought, he held up one finger as a suggestion that they wait. Then he snuck to the staircase. He looked around, clearly saw nobody, and crept down the stairs. Philip followed, just far enough to watch Gary make his way down the stairs. Tyler and Jimmy both went to the handrail, and like Gary before them, they saw nobody. The hall was large, ornate, and empty. The room was a large circle. The wall opposite them was taken up mostly by the immense arched doorway that was being guarded on the other side by the torch-bearing soldiers. Luckily, the door was closed. The wizard saw no reason to change that. The floor was mostly onyx, with soapstone and black granite. The lack of clear color contrast made it difficult to tell, but the floor was inlaid with the same pattern as the six stained glass windows that circled the upper half of the chamber, except where the door was in the way. Big decorative torches blazed away on every wall. There was no furniture. The inlaid pattern on the floor was marred only by two slightly raised platforms, set a bit over halfway between the front and back walls. They were equidistant from each other and the sides of the circular room, like the eyes on a smiley face. On each platform, there was a large lever. Gary reached the bottom of the stairs. He held onto the banister with both hands and looked in every conceivable direction. He looked again. Looked up to Philip at the top of the stairs and to Tyler and Jimmy peering over the railing and raised his eyebrows as if to say, "What the heck?" Gary tiptoed around the end of the banister, into the area immediately in front of the terrace. He took three steps, then glanced into the area beneath the terrace, jumped straight up in the air, and said, "Nyah!" Philip, Tyler, and Jimmy all yelped, cringed, and withdrew several feet into the shadows. Gary leapt back and grasped the banister with both hands, as if he were playing tag and the railing was base. For a moment, they all silently exchanged panicked eye contact, but nothing happened. Finally, Gary ventured to retrace his steps, more slowly this time, and to peek back into the area beneath the terrace. Gary leaned to the side and peered with one eye into the place where he'd seen whatever had startled him. The others remained silent, ready to defend themselves if possible, or, more likely, flee. Gary peered into the area they could not see. The others held their breath. Gary continued to look at whatever it was. Then he waved. Tyler and Jimmy glanced at each other quizzically. Gary gritted his teeth, stood up, and in a loud voice said, "It's a mirror! Come on down, guys!" Philip, Tyler, and Jimmy walked down the stairs. They still made an effort to be quiet, but if Gary's yelp hadn't drawn any attention, nothing they did would. When they reached the bottom of the stairs, they could see that immediately beneath, in the terrace they'd been standing on, the wall was decorated with a spiral design about 20 feet in diameter. It was made of individual slabs of polished stone and looked like a camera's aperture. On either side of the aperture were large decorative mirrors. They were clearly the only people in the chamber, and looking around, it was clear that the only ways in or out were either the massive doors at the front of the room, the stone aperture at the back, or the stained glass windows that ring the upper portion of the wall. Jimmy said, "It's a bit, I don't know, spare, isn't it?" Philip said,
"Well, I'm afraid not everyone has the good taste to coat every available surface in their castle with 14-karat gold, like you did."
"That's not fair," Jimmy said. "It wasn't every surface. I didn't have the marble floors covered with gold foil. One must show some restraint. Besides, I noticed none of you were offended enough by it to tear the castle down once I was gone."
Philip said,
"After all the work the citizens put into building the place, they'd have killed us if we tried to tear it down. We'd already been chased by one murderous mob that week and didn't want to do it again."
Jimmy chose to let the subject drop, as he was the one who had set the first mob on them. He saw no way to win this argument. Tyler was standing on one of the raised platforms. He took the lever in both hands and tried to pull it, but couldn't make it budge.
"Hey, Gary," he said, "there are two levers. Let's try pulling both of them at the same time."
Gary mounted the other platform and grasped the lever. Tyler said,
"On three."
Gary nodded. At the same instant, Tyler said,
"One."
And Gary said,
"Three."
They both stopped. Tyler repeated,
"I said, on three."
Gary said,
"Sorry, I thought we'd count down."
"Well, what sense does that make?"
Tyler asked. If we go on three, then start with three, we pull the levers right away, then just count down to zero afterward. We might as well just say now and pull the levers.
Jimmy said, "Why don't you do that?"
Tyler and Gary both looked at Jimmy, making it clear that his input was not required. Jimmy muttered an apology and looked to Philip, who shook his head ruefully. Gary said,
"Whatever, let's just do this."
Tyler counted to three. Then they both pulled, and with the sound of an enormously heavy lid sliding off the world's largest toilet tank, the aperture in the wall spiraled open like the iris of an immense eye. Torches set into the walls beyond lit a stairway down into inky blackness. Philip and Jimmy approached the opening. The air that rose to meet them smelled like centuries of decay. As Philip and Jimmy started to cross the threshold into the passage below, Tyler and Gary let go of their levers so they could follow. As soon as they were no longer holding the levers in place, the levers whipped back to their original positions, like the throwing arms of synchronized catapults. The stone aperture slammed shut and would have taken Philip's leg if Jimmy hadn't yanked him out of harm's way. Tyler said,
"Huh. Sorry about that, Philip. I guess Gary and I'll wait here."
"I guess,"
Gary agreed. Tyler grasped the handle again and said,
"Okay. On three."
Gary glared at him. Tyler counted to three. The levers were pulled, and the aperture spun open again. Philip and Jimmy approached the opening, keeping an eye on Tyler and Gary as they did. Once they were safely beyond the opening, Philip asked,
"Will it be a problem for you two to hold the door open? I don't know how we'd get a signal to you that we're ready to come out, and we might be coming back out in a hurry."
Tyler said,
"Shouldn't be a problem. What do you think, Gary?"
Gary said,
"Sure, as long as you don't take too long."
Philip and Jimmy walked down the stairs. The torches, set at regular intervals along both sides of the staircase, seemed to stretch into infinity. Thick cobwebs clung to the walls. A layer of dust you could draw in coated the steps. The torches cast large shadows that leapt and danced menacingly as the flames flickered. Philip said,
"Gotta hand it to Todd. He did a good job of making this place seem ancient. I wonder how much time he spent just getting the cobwebs right."
Jimmy said,
"Probably very little. If I had to guess, I'd say that he designed the castle, picked the location and period of history he wanted to put it in, then built this passage a few hundred years earlier. Why artificially age the place when it's just as easy to let it age on its own?"
Philip was amazed.
"All these years of time travel experience, and that still simply didn't occur to me."
Jimmy chuckled.
"Yeah, you and I, we did the same thing. We learned how to time travel and teleport. We found a new time and place to call home. Then we called that good and pretty much stayed there. We made a nest for ourselves. Of course, you did a better job. I made a real hash of it."
"That's what you call it?"
Philip asked.
"You lied, manipulated, accidentally killed an entire town, and tried to kill all the rest of us. And you say you made a hash of it?"
"Yes," Jimmy said, "I do. Because if I dwell on what I did for too long, I spiral into a depression that takes days to drag myself out of. Anyway, back to my original point, we use time travel as a simple means of transportation, but it can be much more. It can be a powerful tool if you think about it."
Philip looked sideways at Jimmy.
"And you've thought about it?"
"While I was in exile, I spent 30 years traveling by foot and bicycle from Argentina to the Pacific Northwest. I had plenty of time to think."
Philip said,
"Hey, wait a minute. Considering what you did, I think 30 years of exile is pretty damned lenient. In fact..."
"Hey, no argument. I did not mean to suggest that I've been treated badly. Really, Phil, at the time I resisted... But in retrospect, I'm nothing but grateful that you didn't just kill me and be done with it. I certainly gave you enough reason. I was just describing the situation, not blaming anyone but myself for it.
Philip said,
okay, then.
But it didn't sound like it was okay.
You've never said that before.
Jimmy said,
we don't exactly talk much, which, again, I don't blame you for. Like I said, I killed a town. If the current manifestation of my punishment is that I'm a pariah, I'm still getting off pretty easy.
The two men walked in silence for several seconds before Jimmy decided to risk saying what was on his mind.
By the way, he said, I think I know that you and Tyler were talking about me back when we first crossed the river.
You think so?
Philip asked.
Yes. It was the first chance you'd had to have a private conversation since the quest started, and I'm pretty sure you were discussing whether or not you could trust me.
Philip nodded.
What do you think?
Jimmy smiled.
There are a few answers to that question. I know that you can trust me, and I don't think you will. I think you were perfectly right to want to discuss it. I think that if I were in your place, I'd have a great deal of difficulty ever trusting me again. I think that if you did trust me, that I'd be extremely reticent to ever betray that trust, unless I had a very good reason. Which sounds bad, but if you think about it, that's the most you can really ever trust anyone. Lastly, I think that if I were you, I'd trust me to do what's best for me. And to that end, let me assure you, it's best for me to keep the three of you alive and happy. I have a much better chance of survival if I have you here to help me. Besides, when we return to Lead Church and have to explain that Jeff is not coming back with us, I fully expect everyone to suspect that I had something to do with it, no matter what you three say. Imagine if I came back without any of you.
Jimmy's analysis of the situation exactly matched Philip's. Philip didn't know how he felt about that. He didn't have long to dwell on it, because in the distance they could see the end of what had looked like an endless line of torches and the entrance to some sort of very well-lit chamber. It was hard to know how far underground they were. The staircase had been several hundred yards long at least. They reached the landing, and the passage widened into a large chamber that appeared to be shaped roughly like a cube. It was full of unusual items. They decided to investigate. Set along the sides of the chamber, there were six large stone bowls, three bowls to each side. Each bowl contained a roaring fire. Beside each bowl, there was a large glass lens set in a bronze fitting, focusing the light from the fire in a specific direction. In the center of the room, on a stone pedestal, there was a statue of a muscular warrior god. The statue had six overdeveloped arms, each wielding a dagger. The daggers had dull metal handles, but the blades were polished to a mirror finish. Also, the arms looked to be jointed at the shoulder so that they could swing through a specific range of motion. On the far wall of the chamber there was an ornately carved stone door, covered with cryptic symbols that neither Philip nor Jimmy recognized. Several feet in front of the door, on either side, there were three large stone cylinders set into the floor, six in total. The cylinders were also covered with cryptic markings. In front of each set of cylinders there was a handrail and a small mirror on a pole. Philip said,
I think it may be some kind of puzzle.
Philip and Jimmy solved the puzzle, but only after quite a bit of trial and error and no small amount of frustration. When stone doors slowly opened, the two men were so relieved they nearly hugged. Their exuberance was muted by the fact that they could hear distant voices coming from the dim passage beyond the door. They crept in as quietly as they could. The passage led to a treasure chamber. Heaped all around the walls were piles and piles of precious objects that had clearly been obtained and hoarded at great effort. There were sculptures of chariots, horses, mighty warriors, and beautiful women, ranging in size from about 4 inches to full size. There were artworks depicting horses, chariots, mighty warriors, and beautiful women hanging on the walls and resting on the floors, leaning against the piles of other glittering loot. There were ostentatious cloaks and boots, hewn from fine fabric and supple leather. Many of them bore pictograms of horses, chariots, mighty warriors, and beautiful women. They littered the floor, far too many for any one man to need. There were also crowns of various size and design, all distinct while remaining essentially the same. Despite the opulence, there were only two real pieces of furniture, a large, comfortable-looking throne, and a stone stand for displaying the most precious possession of all, or at least the most entertaining to look at. Philip thought,
"It's like a bachelor's apartment, dipped in gold."
A gangly king sat at the throne. Dressed in an oversized crown and ermine robes colored green and gold, similar to the robes Jimmy wore back when he called himself Merlin, the king was cackling with delight. His crown slid around on his too narrow head as he rocked with laughter. As the king squirmed with delight, Philip briefly caught a glimpse of his face and immediately recognized it as an unflattering caricature of Jimmy. The object of the king's laughter was instantly clear. On the table opposite the throne rested a beautiful golden birdcage. Inside the cage, a canary that appeared to be made from hammered bronze and clockwork parts was waving its wings and swooning as if it might soon fall unconscious. In front of the table, a short, fat man in a sky-blue court jester costume was leaning on the birdcage with his sweat-stained armpit looming menacingly directly over the poor creature's head. As the clockwork canary choked and the king laughed, the jester stood straight, spun in place, and took a bow. Despite the too prominent nose, the eyes being too close together, and the teeth being too far apart, the jester was clearly meant to be Philip.
"More!"
the king cried, pounding on the arms of his throne.
"More!"
The jester bowed and said,
"As you demand, your stupidity."
The king clapped his hands with delight as the jester turned and regarded the canary, who could only be Oban, the canary the miners had lost. Oban had just stopped coughing and was catching its breath. The jester leaned forward, putting his face right up to the bars of the cage. Oban eyed him wearily. The jester opened his mouth and belched extravagantly right into Oban's face. The metal bird hacked and wheezed, much to the king's delight.
"Urgh,"
Philip moaned.
"It's just so lowbrow."
Through gritted teeth, Jimmy whispered,
"We've gotta save the bird before that fool farts."
Philip's hand went to his sword. He said,
"You take the jester. I'll handle the king."
Jimmy said,
"Done."
The two men rushed from the shadows, swords drawn, screaming bloody murder. Jimmy closed the gap between himself and the jester almost instantly. The jester didn't even have time to raise his hands before Jimmy brought the pommel of his sword down on the jester's skull, instantly knocking him unconscious. Jimmy turned triumphantly to show Philip his handiwork, but was struck speechless by what he saw. The king had managed to rise from his throne and offer some resistance. Not enough, clearly, as the king's left hand and half of his forearm were lying on the stone floor, and Philip's sword was buried deep in the king's ribcage, having gotten there by chopping through the royal trapezius and clavicle. Philip jerked at his sword, but it did not budge. The king slumped down into his throne and leaned backward as far as he could, with Philip's sword protruding from his back. Philip raised a foot, braced it on the king's torso, and pulled his sword free. He turned around to face Jimmy, grinning from ear to ear. He saw the jester, lying unconscious but alive on the ground, and the look on Jimmy's face, and said,
"Oh, Sorry. Look, it wasn't really you.
Jimmy said, yeah, I get it. He lifted the birdcage and said, come on, Oban, let's take you home.
Oban fluttered happily, emitting a slight clanking noise. As they left the treasure chamber, Philip said,
he wasn't real.
Yeah, whatever. I know.
Would it help if I said I was sorry?
Jimmy said,
maybe. If I thought you meant it.
11. When Philip and Jimmy emerged from the stone aperture carrying Oban, the mechanical canary, Tyler and Gary were deep in conversation. They had their backs turned and were holding the levers forward by leaning back on them. Tyler said,
I give you that Kirk was more entertaining on his own to watch, but that's because he made more mistakes. When I said that Picard was a better captain, I meant that I'd rather serve on a ship under his command because he was a better leader.
Gary shook his head.
Okay, Tyler. I just meant that Captain Kirk was better because he was more fun to watch. Because that's all that matters. He's a fictional character. You're talking like you think he and Picard are real people. And that's kind of scary.
Gary, I've heard you say some ridiculous, dishonest things,
Tyler moaned.
But I never thought you'd stoop to that. I say Picard's the better captain, you disagree. And when I prove logically that I'm right, you act like I'm crazy to try to shame me into dropping it. Pathetic.
Whatever you say, Tyler.
Oh, that's even worse. Pretending to humor me because I'm irrational instead of just admitting you're wrong?
Okay, Tyler. If you say so.
Okay, Tyler said. Now you're starting to piss me off.
Philip cleared his throat and said,
guys, sorry to interrupt.
Gary turned, looking relieved.
Don't be. Is that the canary?
Tyler said,
hey, this isn't over.
Gary rolled his eyes.
Okay, Tyler, that's fine. Whatever you say.
Tyler pointed at Gary and started to say something, but Jimmy interrupted.
We'd better get going. We want to be long gone before the sun comes up and someone finds out that Philip killed the king. Philip killed a king?
Gary asked. Philip said,
yeah, I'd rather not talk about it.
Don't be silly, Jimmy said. It's all right. You should tell them all about it later. They'd probably think it was pretty cool. But now we really should get out of here.
They went up the steps to the window through which they'd come in. They might have been able to go out the front door and sneak away behind the soldiers' backs, but none of them liked the idea enough to even bring it up. When they got outside, the night was crisp and quiet, save for the rushing of the water below. Surprisingly, the task of climbing down the buttresses was far more challenging than climbing up had been, partly because they were leading with their clumsy feet rather than their relatively dexterous hands, and partly because the act of descending forced them to look down, which constantly reminded them how much danger they were in. Once they were back on the ground, they immediately left it again, leaping from rock to rock, crossing the river back the way they'd come. Again, it seemed much more difficult this time, since the slight downhill slant the rocks had on the way to the castle was now an uphill slog, making all of the jumps more difficult. Also, the rocks seemed substantially less stable this time. They rocked more alarmingly as Gary, Jimmy, carrying Oban's cage, and Philip leapt one after the other, so that at any given time each of them had a rock to themselves. Tyler went last, and by the time he reached the first rock, it was shaking constantly and felt like it could let go at any second.
Guys!
He shouted.
I hate to rush you, but I kinda need you to move faster!
The others looked back, and seeing how much the boulder was trembling, they did indeed hurry up. Philip had barely vacated a stone when Tyler leapt for it. To everyone's horror, the boulder on which Tyler had been standing broke loose and swept away the instant his foot left it. Tyler landed on all fours on the next boulder, which seemed to have been loosened by the others passing. It was shuddering even more alarmingly than the first boulder. Gary nearly screamed,
Don't worry, Ty! We'll get you out of this!
Tyler scowled over his shoulder at the empty space where he had been standing. His thoughts went back to the first day of the quest and the crumbling rock bridge, and he calmed way down. He muttered, "Oh, man," then yelled, "Don't worry about it." But the others were already hastily scrambling from rock to rock to get him out of his predicament faster. When the next stone was vacant, Tyler made the leap, more in an effort to keep up than out of any sense of self-preservation. He threw himself into the gap between the rocks. The river raged beneath him, and the stone that had just been supporting his weight fell away with the current and was gone before he landed. Philip watched the whole thing and saw that the boulder that was now Tyler's only support was also rocking dangerously. Philip turned to Jimmy and Gary, shouting, "Move! Move! We gotta go! He can't hold on much longer!" Tyler yelled, "No, guys, hold up! Be careful!" He watched miserably as they did neither of those things. Jimmy, already off balance, carrying the large metal birdcage, misjudged a leap and barely made his landing. He teetered sickeningly on one foot, swinging his free leg and arm. Oban clanked and fluttered on his perch as Jimmy swung the cage out over the river, trying desperately to alter his center of gravity. Jimmy finally regained his balance and immediately fell into a crouch. Ahead of him, Gary was scrambling like a gecko, hurling himself to the next rock with abandon. He landed on all fours and nearly slid forward off the far side of the rock. Jimmy had only just regained his footing, but he leapt to the next rock without taking any time to judge the distance. Philip followed suit, landing hard on his stomach when his shoes lost traction on the wet stone. Tyler shouted, "Guys, slow down! You're gonna kill yourselves! I'm not in any more danger than you are!" He could see that it was useless. Philip was now two boulders ahead and had scarcely heard him. Jimmy and Gary were too far away to hear a thing, especially since Gary had already jumped another gap and was nearly to the far bank of the river. Tyler took his time, mentally measuring the distance to the next rock and gathering his strength before committing to the jump. When he landed on the now shaking boulder, he looked back and saw that the boulder from which he had just leapt was gone, traveling downriver at great speed. Tyler looked ahead. Gary was on solid ground now, and even in the dark, at this distance, Tyler could see from Gary's body language that he was deeply concerned. As Tyler watched, Jimmy made the final leap to the relative safety of the riverbank, with a quick helping hand from Gary. Philip threw himself onto the last stone, then forward to the waiting hands of Gary and Jimmy in one fluid movement. They all looked back at Tyler, who was standing five boulders back from them, looking nonchalant. They were all yelling, but Tyler couldn't hear a word over the thunderous roar of the rapids. From their arm motions and general demeanor, he suspected that they were beckoning him to keep trying, to come to them, to not give up. He couldn't help but smile. He knew that they would not be able to hear him, no matter how loud he yelled. So the only way he could communicate was through body language and actions. Tyler stood tall. He moved slowly and deliberately. He stepped to the front of the boulder, taking care to maintain his balance as the rock shook beneath his feet. As gracefully as he could, he jumped to the next rock. He could tell from the terror on the others' faces that the boulder behind him was no longer there. Without looking back, he took his time, judged his distances carefully, and casually jumped to the next rock. The others on the riverbank seemed apoplectic. His attempt to calm them by remaining calm himself clearly was not working. "Oh, well," he thought, "I'll keep at it. Maybe they'll get the hint. And if they don't, it'll be fun to watch them freak out." Tyler had two more jumps until dry land. He stood stock still, watching the others, still yelling themselves hoarse, trying to encourage him forward. Tyler attempted to make eye contact with each of them, no mean feat in the low light. Then he pointed at the unsteady boulder on which he was standing. He took a deep breath, then made the next leap. Without looking behind him, he flourished with his hands to show that he knew that it had washed away once he had moved on. Then he shrugged. Both Philip and Jimmy stopped yelling. They looked at each other, then back to Tyler. Gary was still freaking out, but that didn't surprise Tyler. It wasn't that Gary wasn't smart. His brain was as good as anyone's. He just chose to use it sparingly. Tyler made the next jump. One more and he'd be on the riverbank. Also, he was now within yelling distance of the others.
"Come on!" Gary yelled. "Before the rock gives way!"
Tyler yelled back,
"It's not going to! I can stand here for a year and the rock wouldn't budge!"
Tyler made the final jump to the riverbank, then shouted,
"Todd, that ignoramus, wanted us to hurry and risk our necks, but again he was too lazy or too stupid, or maybe he was lazy and stupid, but anyway, he didn't want to go to the trouble of timing things out and seeing how long we'd take to get across on our own. So instead of making the rocks wash away at a set interval, he just made them go whenever the last of us left them. That way, we panic and hurry without him having to bother to actually put in any effort. Isn't that right, Todd?"
There was no visual sign of Todd's presence, but they heard a microphone click on, and Todd's voice said,
"Yeah, well, it worked for 3 out of 4 of you, didn't it?"
They heard the microphone click off again. They looked at the river. The boulders were gone, leaving nothing but a fast-moving torrent of liquid death. Jimmy said,
"The entire path across the river is gone."
Philip said,
"I guess it's a good thing we don't need to get back in there."
They clambered up the steep slope to the path that would lead them back away from the castle. They worked their way around the far canyon wall, the way they'd come in. By the time morning broke, they were making their way out of the canyon, carrying Oban in his cage, stopping only to fight off pairs of wolves wherever they had killed a single wolf on the way in. They were dead tired. None of them had slept much since they'd left the mine, but they kept moving. There were wolves to contend with, and the paranoid suspicion that the small army they'd left at the castle might be following them. Just before nightfall, they finally dragged themselves into the cursed mines of Mortloch. The miners parted reverently as they approached, holding Oban's cage. The little mechanical canary was fluttering and singing with glee to see its home again. They walked back into the dark interior of the mine, past the miners to Blandoch, the head of the mining guild. Blandoch's face was a picture of delight. Tears of joy filled his eyes as he took Oban's cage from Philip's hands and placed it back on the stone plinth where it clearly belonged. Oban seemed to fly a loop-the-loop in his cage. A mighty cheer rose up from the miners. It all would have been quite moving if they hadn't known that it was part of an elaborate death trap designed by a murderous idiot. Blandoch looked as if his heart might burst, watching Oban tweet and flutter on his perch. After a long, blissful moment, he turned back to the wizards.
"You've lived up to your part of the bargain. You've returned our beloved friend Oban to his rightful home. And now that he is back..."
Blandoch turned to the miners and spread his arms wide, raising his voice.
"We miners can mine again!"
A raucous cheer went up from the miners and echoed deafeningly off the stone walls. When the cheer had died, Blandoch turned back to the wizards and said,
"Now, it is time for us to fulfill our half of the bargain. You came looking for Dailuine, did you not?"
Philip said,
"We did."
Blandoch said,
"And you will have it."
He leaned down to pick up his golden pickaxe in one hand and removed a lantern from its spike, holding it aloft with his other hand.
"Now that Oban is back," he said, "I can go mine it for you."
Blandoch walked toward the mine entrance at the rear of the chamber. Gary asked,
"Aren't you gonna take the bird?"
Jimmy said,
Don't sweat it. No, wait,
Gary said.
The whole point of having a canary in a mine is to take it with you to tell you if the air is bad. I'm sure he knows what he's doing,
Jimmy said.
No,